This is after the bayat has been done and the initial address that Ali had. Later on, when things were kind of settled down, that the people in Medina have now accepted him as the Khalifa, then he comes into the masjid wearing the amama of Rasulullah and the aba of Rasulullah and wearing the na'lain, the slippers of Rasulullah. And then he got on the minbar. Now, how he got on the minbar, where he sat, it's another story, inshallah, we'll talk about it tomorrow. According to Asbad bin Nubata, who was an orator in his own right and a poet, he says, Ali sat down with his finger locked, and then he started talking. And this is the first time you hear those words which have been repeated 4 to 5 times as far as the record of history is concerned, where he says, Ya ma'shar al-nas, O people, saluni saluni qablan tafqiduni. Ask me whatever you want before you lose me. فَهَذَا صَفَّةُ الْعِلْمِ هَذَا لِعَابُ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ هَذَا مَا ذَقَّنِ رَسُولِ اللَّهِ زَقًّا زَقًّا. This is the container of knowledge, referring to himself. This is the saliva of Rasulullah, whatever he said has come to me. And this is what Allah's messenger has fed me, the way feeding should be done from the teacher to the student. And then he says, Saluni fa'inna indi ilmul awwaleen wal akhireen. Ask me, because with me is the knowledge of the early and the later prophet.
Listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Interfaith activities that connect ordinary Muslim and Jewish people to build mutual understanding seems like a good idea. What could possibly be wrong with that? But this benign objective's being manipulated. Today, we'll look at how the Zionist regime is attempting to weaponize goodwill between women of different faiths to normalize Zionism in the Muslim community. I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more after this special report from Palestinian commentator Latifa Abu Chakra about how one influential group is abusing interfaith activities to normalize Zionism.
The name Nisa' Nashim, a combination of the Arabic and Hebrew words for women, denotes a harmony for all. It elevates the idea of coexistence. The question is, coexistence with what exactly? Nisa' Nashim was founded in 2016 and is seemingly in potentially terminal decline. Today we ask, what was it in the first place and who exactly is behind it? Nisa' Nashim claims to be an interfaith partnership between Muslim and Jewish women. In reality, it's a vehicle for normalizing Zionism in the Muslim community. The pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews even admits that it incubated Nisa' Nashim. The group also claims it has two co-founders, one Muslim and one Jewish. In reality, there was a third undisclosed founder. The first co-founder of Nisa' Nashim, Laura Marks, was previously the senior vice president of the Board of Deputies. The Board of Deputies, according to its own trustees report, has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy in the UK through the ambassador, diplomats, professional staff, and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the Israeli Defense Forces. Another co-founder, Julie Siddiqui, has a long history of working with the British Armed Forces. In 2014, she was briefed by the Ministry of Defence on British military operations in Iraq. She claimed that our concerns and feedback have been taken on board and taken seriously. She added, "I can't see any other country in the world where you would have something like this, so it is something that we should be proud of." Denise Joseph is the third undisclosed founder, the only one that remains a director. She describes herself as an ardent Zionist and is the chair of the European Board of One Voice, an anti-BDS organization that pushes normalization propaganda in British schools. Another director, Hifsa Haroon Iqbal, is simultaneously the regional Prevent lead for the West Midlands. Prevent is a British government spying program in which children as young as three can be questioned by counter-terror police without parents present. It is overseen by the Homeland Security Group, which is one of the seven agencies and departments that form the UK intelligence community. But who funds Nusrat Nashim? Well, it states that it has been funded by the Department for Communities and Local Government and the Board of Deputies. It has also received funding from David Dangor, whose family foundation also funds the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society and the Board of Deputies. The foundation has also given money to the Jerusalem Foundation, an organization involved in promoting illegal settlement activity in occupied East Jerusalem. So, here we have an interfaith subterfuge organization working to blunt criticism of the Zionist movement in the Muslim community by leveraging personal contacts and friendships. No to Nusrat Nashim.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David is an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined by the chair of the Islamic Human Rights Commission in London, Masood Sajjara. Masood, I think you've expressed some concerns, haven't you, about how interfaith is being used as a sort of soft infiltration by the Zionist movement. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been clearly seen by Muslims and Jews and others who are opposing Zionism as instrumental in trying to normalize. And indeed, by the claim of those who are involved in this work, themselves admit that this is the reason. Once you get to know people, once you actually have personal relationships, then you're not going to be as harsh against the illegal occupation, apartheid, and the brutal occupation. And that's the task, to do that exactly. And they're really systematically involved in it.
David, you know these links to Nusrat Nashim, I mean, are these isolated examples by the Zionist movement, or is this a more widespread thing, do you think?
No, there are two sorts of people who are involved in the leadership of Nusrat Nashim. On the one hand, there are people who are Muslim, who are fully paid-up advocates of British counter-terror policy. On the other hand, there are people who are Zionists, who have a long experience in the Zionist movement. One of them even used to work for the Israeli government. And this is a very extensive set of connections. And indeed, it goes back further than this. I mean, the setting up of Nusrat Nashim was something which was pioneered. The whole idea of these kinds of organizations was pioneered by the Israeli government itself in its Global Forum for Countering Anti-Semitism back in 2013. They started discussing how they could leverage personal friendships in order to protect the state of Israel from criticism.
Mm. I mean, Masood, I think you've said that it's a betrayal to work with these groups, and the many Zionists have criticised you for that viewpoint. I mean, how would you respond to that?
Well, I find both from Islamic perspective and sort of main principles of humanity, you can't really get involved on the same platform with racists, with people who are systematically abusing, trying to legitimise racism and illegal occupation and apartheid. You know, to get involved with them on the same platform is really outrageous. I think I would be quite happy to sit down and debate against them, which is something we should do. But to legitimize them and legitimize this sort of activity and keep silence on all these abuses of one of the most brutal illegal occupation, it really is a crime. I think, you know, as a human rights activist, I won't do it. But in the same time, all the time, systematically, we are in partnership with many Jews who are anti-Zionist, and they are our comrades, and we are really fighting anti-Semitism in a way that nobody else is doing.
I mean, David, there was a reference in the VT that we just saw there to the role of the Ministry of Defence and an allusion to the British Security Services. I mean, do you think that's significant?
It is, I'm afraid. Most of the work of PREVENT, which is the British government's counter-terror policy, and some of the extremism work as well, involves funding a whole series of civil society groups. And these are funded and run through an organisation called the Homeland Security Group of the Home Office, which is a British intelligence agency. And people who are involved with Nissan Nashim, one of their trustees, is a PREVENT coordinator, is effectively an asset of British intelligence. And others involved are associated with organisations which are funded by, secretly funded and covertly funded, by the propaganda department of the Home Office. And so they're also, in effect, assets of British intelligence. Now, this is not a technical thing. This is actually how those organisations are run. They're run with influence and money, and indeed editorial control by British intelligence agencies. And there's no recognition of this in the wider community, and it should be much more widely known.
I mean, it's argued, Masoud, is that building these sort of personal relationships, between communities makes it less likely that that people will fall out, as it were. I mean, do you think that's a plausible reason?
Well, that's what they sort of state themselves, those who are involved. Yeah. They say that this is the reason. And they give an example that they did it with the Christian community, and it led to Christian Zionism. And now they're trying to repeat that within the Muslim community. And indeed, it's very frightening. I've seen on Google, if you search, there are some people who identify themselves as a Muslim Zionist. So that is the task. On one side, they're promoting these people because they have access to power. On the other side, they're silencing everybody else.
I mean, David, how do you think these sort of interfaith groups relate to sort of foreign policy strategies of the Zionist regime?
Well, the groups like Nissan Nashim, and there are many others, there's a whole network of interfaith organisations run by similar sorts of people, and sometimes the same people. And they relate very closely to the foreign policy objectives of Israel, of the Zionist state. As I mentioned before, the Global Forum on Countering Anti-Semitism has been discussing this. There's been a special working group since 2013. They've been discussing it since 2007. And there it's set out very clearly the value of personal relationships and the need to try and leverage these personal relationships to dull down and counter criticism of the state of Israel. And in 2015, their working group made similar sorts of recommendations. There was a person on it, on the working group from the UK, who's also sat on interfaith boards with the Board of Deputies. And only a year after these discussions and proposals were put out by the Global Forum, Nissan Nashim itself is created. So it's almost directly a kind of result of that. It said on the website of the Board of Deputies that it was incubated. It incubated Nissan Nashim. So this is a product of Israel lobby groups directed in a strategy by the State of Israel.
Mm. Yeah, I'm going to say, Masoud, I mean, we're often, when these sorts of facts come out, accused of indulging in conspiracy theories. I mean,
well, the facts speak for themselves. There is not a single rabbi in interfaith structure which is anti-Zionist or pro-Palestinian. You know, pro-Palestinianism is actually a crime when it comes to these groups. There's no good pro-Palestinian, and everything is to do with promoting Israel. It's very clear.
Interesting, yeah. Well, look, let's pause the discussion there for a moment if we can, because we've got another report from Latifa Abu Chakra about what she found when she recently attended a Nissan Nashim meeting on Ramadan.
Nissan Nashim claims to be all about mutual understanding and inspiring leadership and social change, but we found that it seems to be more about normalising Zionism and collaborating with British intelligence agencies and counter-terrorism work. I wanted to see how this works in practice, so I went to one of their online meetings. Before I went, I checked out the person running the meeting, a Muslim woman called Saliha Islam. It turns out, like many others associated with Nisat Nashim, she has connections to the counter-extremism apparatus of the British government. She is associated, for example, with Faith's Associates, a group which has worked covertly with the Home Office's Homeland Security Group, a part of the British intelligence apparatus. I wanted to ask some questions about Nisat Nashim. Let's see.
I wanted to know that given the Board of Deputies have said that it incubated Nisat Nashim and the fact that it supported it financially, and the Board of Deputies saying that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy, why would Muslims trust this organization? And there is one in particular for you, Sliha. Given the connections that you have to Prevent and the research, information and communications unit in the Home Office, of which are both intelligence projects, Saliha, you're linked directly to an asset of British intelligence. Why would anyone believe that Nisat Nashim is not a British intelligence asset?
May I answer as a trustee of Nisat Nashim the first question? And we were not incubated. We have separated ourselves. We are now registered with the Charity Commission. We are an independent entity and no longer have links. Yes, we have relationships and we do work with Board of Deputies, especially when we are dealing with anti-Semitism. And I let Saliha respond. Saliha, this is about Ramadan. So
yeah, this is, yeah. So this is about Ramadan. And
yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. This program is a...
Yeah, Hajra, I can speak. Thank you. I don't know what you're talking about in terms of RICO, whatever, and also in terms of Prevent. As a director of many organizations, you have to work with different organizations across the board. So I am not part of anything. I'm not a Prevent office or anything like that.
Can we take this offline? Sorry, Latifa. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut you off here.
I'm here asking these questions because obviously it's...
I realize that.
We're talking about a spiritual matter. If we're talking about Ramadan and we're talking about the spiritualness of Ramadan and the practice, then we also need to uphold the good. As it says in the Quran, you know, you uphold the good and you forbid the evil. If Prevent targets Muslim communities and puts children as young as 3 years old under the inspection of police officers without their parents.
So I think you're going off track here. So
I'm sorry,
we can't have that. Let everybody else know that, I mean, if this sort of discussion goes off, we will have to remove you from the site.
Overall, it seems like an attempt to get women to get on with each other personally, so that it's more difficult in the future for them to argue when Israel next attacks Gaza or indulges in ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem.
Wow, that was a pretty damning indictment, Masood. I wonder whether you could say whether, you know, Muslims in general are aware of the sort of agenda behind what this looks like a seemingly innocent venture.
No, they're not. I mean, I think very large section of Muslim community on grassroots, they're really not aware of it. They are committed to sort of having a relationship with the Jewish community and the Christian community because they live in the West. And this is actually basically a covert thing to use that sentiment of ordinary people and sort of bring Zionism and legitimization of Zionism and silencing of the community through backdoor. And I think we need to have alternative to this. People who want to have a relationship with Jewish community, which we should promote, should not be forced to have it with the Zionists as a representative of the Jewish community. Mm.
David, what do you make of this notion of faith associates that came up?
Well, Faith Associates is one of these civil society groups which appears to be a Muslim grassroots entity, but which is in actuality covertly funded through RICU, the propaganda department of the Home Office, which is itself part of the British intelligence apparatus. So Faith Associates, which the chair of this meeting is associated with, is on their website as being working for them, is effectively part of an organisation which has been a British intelligence asset. Now, that's a really quite a serious allegation to make, but it's perfectly clear that that's the case. It's just that nobody really talks about it in those terms. They say, well, it's not a very good organisation, or they don't like it, or its politics are dodgy. But actually, the issue here is this is an organisation which is being used by the British intelligence agencies to penetrate the Muslim community and to make sure that they can undermine pro-Palestinian activism. And that's the purpose.
Masood, what's your thoughts about the connections to, I think many people regard as the kind of racist prevent strategy and this organization? I mean, how do you...
Well, I think what happened after 9/11, it was happening before, but to much lesser degree. After 9/11, Israeli intelligence services became much more involved in directing the direction of anti-terrorism in this country. And as experts, it's almost like saying that we want to deal with how we deal with the black community, so we went to apartheid state to get some clues. This is outrageous. And that has been contributing to this factor that Zionism and promotion of Zionism or normalization has become one element of anti-terrorism. And, you know, Cameron, for example, said it very clearly. Good Muslims are the ones who have relationship with the Jewish community, this. And even things like Big Iftar, it really is there to inject the on behalf of the Jewish community, Zionist community, in there, into the mosque, to actually normalize. That has to stop. Mm.
I mean, David, you talked a bit about the significance of the role of the British intelligence. Maybe say a bit more about the British intelligence's involvement and role in this whole process.
Well, there's an organisation, used to be an organisation in the Home Office called the Office for Security and Counterterrorism. And it's now been renamed the Homeland Security Group. Not many people know that. Mm. And it runs a whole slew of counterterrorism and counter-extremism organisations, Muslim civil society organisations all over the country. They have a different number of different programmes for that, for both counter-terrorism and for counter-extremism. Now, these are organisations which are given free help by a PR agency. Now, some of the time, these organisations themselves don't really know that this PR agency, which is helping them for free, is actually contracted directly to RICU, the propaganda agency of the Home Office, which is an intelligence agency. And they don't know that in secret, when they go to the hub, as it's called, of this PR agency, that there are two intelligence personnel sitting in the small office who are covertly there and pretending to be simply members of the marketing agency, helping them with their marketing campaigns. And that they have, at every stage of the operation, editorial control over every word and every comma in every campaign that's run by these organisations. Now, that's something which is not known about, which comes from leaked documents from inside RICU, and that's what we see here. This is an organisation, one of many, many organisations, which are run by or in the interests of British intelligence. We say in the vocabulary of the intelligence services themselves, these are assets of British intelligence. Mm-hmm. If you look at the MI5 website, they define assets, covert human information sources in that way. These are not officers of MI5, but they are assets. And that's what we find in this kind of organisation, including in the case of Nishan Nashim, one of the trustees is actually a prevent officer, who's effectively working directly for the intelligence services.
So they're kind of acting as sort of infiltrators, but what's the aim? I mean, what are they seeking to achieve?
Well, the aim is twofold. I mean, on the one hand, there's a normalisation of Zionism, which is the aim of the Israeli government and the Zionist movement. But the British government are on board for part of that. They want to help that, but because they want to penetrate Muslim communities to take the sting out of pro-Palestinian activism. That's what they've been doing since 9/11, targeting Muslims because they see Muslims as being a significant source of opposition to British foreign policy, as indeed they are. Mm-hmm. So it's an attempt to penetrate the Muslim community, to damp down pro-Palestinian sentiment, and to certainly damp down sentiment which opposes British foreign policy, which, of course, as we see, every day goes from worse to worse.
Masoud, the information that we've revealed in this report today, I think, is pretty damning. How do you think Muslim organisations and the Muslim community in general should respond to the information that we've revealed in this programme?
Really, there are very dangerous sort of concepts for the future of Muslim community. These concepts that being pro-Palestinian automatically or makes you a terrorist or prone to terrorism is something that unfortunately has been established by the security forces and being pushed by the Zionists and their elements. And that is what is being promoted. You know, we got youngsters having a badge of Free Palestine being referred to prevent. And, you know, so the actual fact is to silence pro-Palestinianism through prevent, through terrorism, through anti-terrorism, and demonize the whole section of people, replace the leadership into people who are already on sort of prevent payrolls, and they're actually looking for better jobs and better prospect, and the security forces and the government is pushing that line. This is actually very dangerous, because what it does is actually doesn't address the real concern of ordinary citizens, be it Muslims or others, who are asking, saying why we are not dealing with the issue of apartheid, why we are not dealing with the issue of war crimes, why we are not dealing with the issue of illegal occupation, and we are silencing, if anything, we are silencing people using these elements of anti-terrorism, etc., etc. We need to liberate ourselves from this. If we are going to sort of have a prosperous Muslim community, which is independent but supportive of our society, we need to actually eliminate these sort of prevent and intelligence services from making decisions which direction it should go.
I mean, David, what do you think then should be done about these sort of covert manipulative groups? Do you think they should be registered maybe as agents of a foreign power, or just closed down altogether perhaps?
Well, I think that the idea of registering them as a agent of a foreign power has a certain attractiveness. Of course, you'll know that the Americans did this in 1938, before the Second World War, because there were Nazis operating in the US in service of Nazi Germany, and they did this Foreign Agents Registration Act, which exists to this day, in which Zionist groups, as well as other groups from foreign powers, have to register and disclose their activities. So I think that would be fantastic. Let's register all the Zionist organisations and force them to disclose what it is they're doing to try and influence government policy. Fantastic, let's do that. It's already been discussed in Parliament. We should do this, but of course only in relation to our official enemies, in relation to Russia, for example. But, you know, I don't object to that in relation to Russia, but let's make sure we have all the other countries there too.
OK, well, thanks very much indeed, both of you. I'm afraid we've run out of time, but thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, new burdens, low pay and a pandemic have prompted the resignations of a fifth of the legal workforce in New York City's Manhattan, the Bronx and Brooklyn. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jonah Bromwich. The piece is titled, Why Hundreds of New York City Prosecutors Are Leaving Their Jobs. New New York City's prosecutors are leaving in droves, citing pandemic burnout, low salaries, and two intersecting laws that fundamentally changed the nature of their jobs. They just simply can't do it anymore, Darcel Clark, the Bronx district attorney, said in a Friday interview. The money is not where it should be, and the work-life balance is just unmanageable. This year alone, 36 have left the Brooklyn district attorney's office, and 44 have left Manhattan district attorney's office. At least 28 have left the Bronx, and the 9 Staten Island assistant district attorneys who have left this year represented about 10% of that office's prosecutorial staff. The Queens office told the New York City Council that it was on track this year to more than double last year's resignations. In the past year, the Manhattan and Brooklyn district attorneys, who have about 500 prosecutors each, lost almost a fifth of that workforce, a sharp increase from attrition averages before 2020. The Bronx is shedding lawyers at a similar pace, a total of 104 since July. The district attorneys are replacing their previous employees when they can, often exchanging experienced prosecutors for untested ones. When the pandemic arrived in New York 2 years ago, it disrupted nearly all court proceedings. At the same time, 2 new state laws took effect governing discovery. The sharing of all evidence, potential evidence, and other case-related material. Prosecutors say the measures, which were intended to make trials fairer to defendants, create onerous amounts of paperwork. The first law requires prosecutors to obtain and hand over hundreds of documents on many cases, a demanding task that can impede interviewing witnesses and otherwise preparing for court. A second law ties the handover of that material to the speedy trial clock, creating deadline pressure for prosecutors to collect all the material once charges are filed. That law is known as Caliph's Law, named for Caliph Broder, a teenager who committed suicide after being held on Rikers Island for 3 years without a trial. For instance, if a defendant blew into a breathalyzer, a defense attorney is entitled to 6 months' worth of calibration reports on that device. Prosecutors also have a continuing obligation to hand over a similar number of calibration reports filed after the defendant used the device. The new laws aren't the only reason for departures. District attorneys say that their city-funded budgets are too thin to allow them to pay prosecutors competitively. Despite the cost of living in Manhattan and Brooklyn, starting salaries for prosecutors in those boroughs is $72,000. In Bronx, it is $75,121. And of course, the trend has coincided with the pandemic, which has caused record numbers of voluntary resignations across all industries. District attorneys say their employees are struggling. Ms. Clark said her office's lawyers, inundated with paperwork, could make $30,000 more doing similar tasks for law firms, which might also let them work from home. Why not do that, she said. State lawmakers rewrote the discovery law in 2019 after defense attorneys said that prosecutors were withholding key evidence. The previous law required them to turn over certain evidence only after defense attorneys had requested it in writing. Because defendants, a disproportionate number of whom are people of color, were not privy to the full scope of the evidence against them, they often accepted plea deals rather than risk going to trial. The defense bar was basically completely in the dark about what the case was even about, said John Bozza, a former prosecutor at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who now practices defense law as a partner at Contra George and Bozza PC. Public defenders argued that without pressure on prosecutors to turn over exculpatory facts, Their clients were perpetually at risk of wrongful conviction. The discovery law changed that. Prosecutors are now obligated to turn over 21 kinds of material, including all electronically created or stored information relevant to a case. Prosecutors now must hustle to obtain reams of paperwork, much of it produced by the New York Police Department and submitted to defense attorneys, or risk seeing a case tossed out. Prosecutors often worked as many as 100 cases simultaneously, and a large percentage of their cases now generate significant paperwork. Ms. Clark said that the workload had led to immense pressure on her assistants, who feel that their cases are going to get dismissed or that I'm going to fire them. When they have all this pressure on them, they'd rather go somewhere else where their quality of life is better, she said. They don't have to work nights, weekends, holidays, and do all this discovery. Caitlin Nolan, an 11-year veteran of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, said in an interview on Friday that she started looking for a new job last spring amid the challenges of working on a low salary, the everyday difficulties of the pandemic, and frustration with new laws. She left the office in January of this year. It was difficult to comply with because there was so much we were expected to produce, she said, adding that having to provide information about witnesses who would express concern to her about defendants knowing their identities ahead of a trial was particularly nerve-wracking. In recent testimony submitted to the New York City Council, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, illustrated the burden. He reported that before 2020, his office used about 32 terabytes of data storage. Today, it uses 320 terabytes of data storage, a 900% increase over a period of 2 years. Tina Luongo, the attorney in charge of the criminal defense practice at the Legal Aid Society, said that she agreed that prosecutors and public defenders needed more money for competitive salaries, particularly in the light of the discovery laws. High workloads, even high workloads for public defenders, diminish morale. I'm not going to deny that, she said, adding that she expected the state to provide local prosecutors with tens of millions of dollars for staffing in its coming budget. But she said, it cannot be the case that, and it must not be the case that the way you solve a workload problem is to diminish the rights of somebody accused of a crime.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back.
La 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 la
We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are talking about some of the Ramadan-related issues, laws, jurisprudential status, according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Sheikh Javid, let me start with this question. Since we are in this month of mercy, let me ask you this question. When does a girl have to fast? What is the age in which, in fact, she becomes, or it becomes obligatory for her to, in fact, commence fasting?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, a girl attains the age of puberty at the completion of 9 lunar years. And when she attains this age, it becomes obligatory for her to start fasting, observing hijab, praying, and performing any other religious duties. And it is highly recommended that a girl starts praying and doing other obligatory acts long before she attains this age of puberty. And of course, there are many people who wonder about their daughters being very weak, being very, for example, incapacitated or some kind of maybe problems in the hot days of the summer season.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that is a different scenario. You know, the religion of Islam does not burden or does not actually obligate a person beyond a person's capacity, beyond a person's ability. So if a girl is actually unable to fast, she is not supposed to fast, because the religion of Islam does not want to put unbearable difficulty or hardship on a person. Now, we are speaking about a girl who is not, for example, who has attained the age of puberty, but she has to, but she cannot fast because she is either very weak and she does not have the constitution or the ability to fast. So in that case, she can break her fast, and then obviously she has to observe the qada of the fast at a later time.
Sheikh Javed, would you talk about or shed some light on the age of puberty, in fact, for both sides, boys and girls, first of all?
That's a good question, because there is, you know, a little discrepancy about the age of girls especially. There are some few scholars who believe that the age of puberty is 13, you know. But that's not the common position held by the Shiite scholars. According to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, as well as Grand Ayatollah Sistani, when a girl attains the age of puberty, she becomes baligh, you know, she becomes adult and mature, and she has to start fasting. Now, when it comes to boys, of course, a boy attains the age of puberty at the completion of 15 lunar years. And of course, there are other signs also which if those signs appear, those signs actually show or indicate that the boy has attained puberty. One of them is, for example, ejaculation, and that the other is the growth of coarse hair around the genital area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, these are the three signs. Okay, one is the completion of,
for both males and females.
No, for boys only. For boys
okay.
only. For girls, it's only completion of 9 lunar years.
Lunar years.
For boys, of course, there are three signs. One is completion of 15 lunar years, and then the growth of coarse hair or rough hair around the genital area. And then there is the ejaculation. If a boy, for example, starts ejaculating at the, let's say he is 13 years old or maybe 14, he has not started even becoming, he has not entered the 15th year of his age.
Okay.
But he starts ejaculating, that means he has attained the age of puberty and he has to observe fast.
I see. Okay, let's take a short break and we'll be back continuing our program, in fact, with the month of Ramadan and the issues and the laws, Islamic laws related to that. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed is still in the studio with us, shedding light on some of the Islamic laws related to fasting. And before the break, Sheikh Javed, I asked you a question about the age of puberty, and obviously we are talking about bodily, in fact, maturity, right? we are not talking about the legal status or the legal age of puberty, right? Which is somehow considered in some countries like to be 18, 19, 20,
yes,
or 21,
you're right,
depending on the states or provinces where they are, right?
The Sharia standard of maturity or adulthood is different from the legal standard, you know?
Yes.
According to the, according to some countries' law, for example, a girl or a boy who is not yet, who has not completed 18 is not considered to be adult, so he is not held responsible for his deeds or actions.
And some stuff, for example, in some countries are not going to be sold, for example, to person on the age, they
sure.
say. Right?
You're right.
But let me ask you a question quite related to this Sharia or, you know, ritual kind of puberty that we are talking about, or the age of puberty for especially a girl. She cannot fast, for example, in the month of Ramadan due to her weak constitution or built.
Yes.
All right? And she's unable also to, let's say, perform the qadha of the missed days of fasting until the next Ramadan. So what's the status? What's the jurisprudential ruling in this regard?
The obligation of fasting or performing the qadha of the missed fast is not actually removed or waived, you know, waived, you know, just because of weakness. And weakness is not an excuse, because, okay, there are many people who are weak, you know, bodily, physically, they look to be very weak. But weakness is not a good or a valid excuse for not fasting. So in that case, if a person or if a girl simply because she thinks she is not, you know, fit for fasting, she's not ready, and because she is weak or she cannot fast, so the qaza of the missed days of fasting in Ramadan will remain obligatory for her. You know, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if because of weakness and if because of incapacity, because of a lack of, you know, because of a lack
power.
Of power or ability, she finds herself unable to fast, then of course she has to give the qadha of the fast only, and there is no penalty, no kafara on her. So whenever she can give it, she should give the qadha, and the sooner the better.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you, dear audience, for listening to this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Please do remember us, in fact, in your supplication, prayers, and du'as, especially in this month of mercy and barakah. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.